WSHD1, Los Angeles. This is the Rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
We had Ron Chernow on this show probably seven, eight years, whatever year his book, Alexander Hamilton, came out. We had Ron on for an hour to talk about that great work. And also, we had him on for his George Washington book. By the way, Chernow has a new book, biography of Ulysses Grant, coming out, I think, in October. But when I had Ron Chernow on, I had no idea that a genius named Lin-Manuel Miranda would turn that into a musical, and not just a musical, a musical of such importance and brilliance that it really is an instant classic. It joins the canon of West Side Story, My Fair Lady, whatever, of something that will be a permanent part of the theater landscape. And it's coming to Los Angeles in August at the Pantages. My wife and I were lucky enough to have seen the original company in New York. And then she's such a hamhead, she went to Chicago to see it. And, of course, we got our tickets. But here's what's been going on underneath the headlines about the show. The creators of this amazing work wanted to make sure that the next generation of Americans would learn about the Founding Fathers and see the show. But it's pricey. So they set up a program called Ham for Hamilton, $10 tickets so high school kids can go, and thousands have. But they went even deeper than that. They wanted to make sure that the young people who saw the show were had a foundation in the Founding Fathers. They understood the context, the story of America that they were going to go see in greater detail. And the organization that put together the curriculum for this is the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. And joining us right now to talk about this is the president of the Gilder Lehrman Institute, James Basker. Good morning, Mr. Basker. How are you?
Doug, good morning. I'm great and happy to be on the show.
Oh, I couldn't be happier to have you. I love this show. I think this show is not only an amazing theatrical experience, funny and dramatic and moving and musical, but it's genuinely important. To sit at the Richard Rogers Theater in New York when we saw it and to hear an audience literally cheer as each founding father comes on stage as if they're rock stars is to do something for, I think, as you described it, the castor oil of history education that is unthinkable. They made it sexy. They put the flesh and blood back into these very real and very dramatically important human beings.
There's no question of that. And through this EduHam program, which is coming to, as you say, to Los Angeles in the fall, we're reaching kids who I think largely may have thought history had nothing to do with them. And they're connecting not just as good students, but as people who really care about these human beings and about the issues they fought and debated over. They see themselves on stage, people who look like them in the cast. They're doing a curriculum that involves them and unleashes their creative powers. It's such a phenomenon, Doug. I've never seen anything like it in more than 30 years in education.
Well, I've never seen it either. And, you know, I oftentimes despair over our country because of this issue. I know that, you know, we cover terrorism, we cover all kinds of terrible issues, the crazy North Korea with nuclear weapons, etc. And those things are exceptionally dangerous, but they cannot destroy America. What can destroy America, in my opinion, is raising multiple generations of Americans who are disconnected from the traditions of the country, because nations are become homelands when you have the connective tissue that links the generations together. And I really think that we have severed that tie in a lot of ways, that the founders seem like distant, remote. In some people present them as oppressors, when it's exactly the opposite, that the reality is so much better than the myth, if you take the time to teach it and to learn it. And that's what I think Chernow did with his book, Hamilton, and certainly Lin-Manuel Miranda and the creative geniuses behind the show have done musically.
There's no question about that. And it was actually Ron Chernow, who's a very good friend of the Gilder Lehrman Institute, who made the introduction originally to Lin and his father, Luis, Jeffrey Seller, the producer, lead producer of Hamilton, and we got started a couple of years ago. But to pick up on your point, some of the stories within the show, the story of Alexander Hamilton himself as an immigrant who comes into the mainstream of America and makes it through his own grit and talent and hard work. There's so many stories that radiate out for these kids, and we're seeing responses from kids that we could never imagine. Let me give you an example. We had our gala in New York a week ago, and we brought in from Chicago a young woman, a senior in high school, who was one of the student performers at the Chicago production. And her original contribution was that she did a song in the voice of George Washington at Valley Forge, singing the blues. And she had a beautiful church choir voice, and she just melted everybody in the room. But her way in was imagining Washington as a frustrated, miserable leader with his soldiers eating their horses and all of that, begging Congress for support. She saw her way in, and she didn't see Washington as a slave owner and oppressor. She saw him as a person who was one of her American forebears who struggled in this pivotal crisis, and she gave it voice in the most beautiful way.
We're talking with James Baskers, the president of the Gilder Lehrman Institute. Gilder Lehrman, it's GilderLehrman.org is the website. Tell us what happens in a classroom. How do schools, which L.A. schools get this program? How does the whole thing work?
Well, let me tell you the basic shape of it. We started in New York with a Rockefeller grant helping us. We moved to Chicago. Now this show, which has been in San Francisco, is coming to L.A. There will be 120 Los Angeles schools, all of them Title I schools. That is where 60% or more of the kids are eligible for free lunch. These are the poorest schools, the poorest populations in the city. There will be more than 7,300 students who will experience the show. Here's what happens. It's a teacher-led curriculum that the teachers receive weeks before they come to the theater. And they teach the kids for two or three weeks about the founding era and the major players, major events. Then they turn them loose in a curated website, which we've put together, which has 30 important characters from the founding era, including Phyllis Wheatley and others who are not in the show but are important in that time, and a dozen major events. The kids then are assigned to do an original project investigating original manuscripts, documents connected with each of those characters or events. They can do it on their own or in a pair or even a trio. And they do their research. They decide which of these figures they want to investigate further. And then instead of an exam or an essay, they do an original song or rap piece or poem or even a dramatic scene. Every kid in the classes prepares one of these and submits it in writing. And then on the day of the theater visit, the kids come in the morning. There might be 20 or 30 schools represented, and the best act from each school will perform live at the theater before the whole audience. They'll later, in the second hour, they'll have a Q&A session, a talk back with members of the cast, asking them historical questions or do you get nervous before you go on stage, things that give them access to the actors directly. And then in the afternoon, they're going to see a matinee performance of Hamilton, one of the hardest tickets to get in the world. And these kids, most of whom have never been in a theater, will be experiencing it in the most exciting way.
It's not hyperbole to say that this can be a life-changing experience for young people because it's like a crash course in one of the most amazing stories. The founding of this country, I really believe, is a secular miracle that a nation of 2.5 million white people Because I make that distinction because they're the only ones who had a say in what was happening at that time, managed to produce, at least six certifiable geniuses and dozens of remarkably competent people all at the same time. Hamilton, and I'm so happy for this because we live in Hamilton's world. I mean, Jefferson is the sexy and easy to point to shiny object. Sort of like a star in the crown of the founding fathers. But we live in Hamilton's world, and if you actually put them side by side, I've long believed that Hamilton was right about many more things than Jefferson was. Hamilton having come from, first of all, he was an American in the sense that he didn't have loyalty to a colony. Jefferson died a Virginian. Hamilton, born in Nevis and in the Caribbean and coming to the United States as a teenager and going to Princeton, then ultimately Columbia University, which was King's College at the time, did not have a loyalty to a colony or a state. So he had a continental vision. And he also did not come from the slaveocracy. He believed in free labor. He had seen the horrors of slavery at the slave markets in the Caribbean. And he created a system of economics that actually was based on free labor, as opposed to Jefferson, who was still propping up the landed aristocracy of the Tidewater South.
Doug, you put it extremely well. In fact, that last two sentences of yours are a crash course in history by themselves. But you're absolutely right. Hamilton laid down ideas that are the template we're living today. I wouldn't leave Jefferson out.
No, I wouldn't
because
either.
The Declaration of Independence
important.
Gave us an opening that really we're still fulfilling.
Right. And he deserves to be in the pantheon. But it's interesting that we almost lost Hamilton from the $10 bill. And arguably, that was the last presence he had in American culture, that it made a fleeting glimpse going in and out of your wallet, mostly out, by the way, of my wallet. But but now, because of this show, he was saved.
That's very true. But I also think that meaningful connections to the founding era and their application to civic life today are also what's being saved. And the miracle of this show is that I think we have the possibility over the next few years, because, of course, kids everywhere are singing the music. They know the lyrics of these
songs. One of the most successful original cast albums ever.
Yeah. And so it's in our language. Like Shakespeare, the language and the ideas of Hamilton are entering our everyday speech, but at lightning speed. And we're having class after class of students who are young adults and going to be voters in the next 10 minutes, basically. Over the next few years, I think we have the chance to change the chemistry of our civic life, beginning with the youngest generations.
We're talking with James Basker, president of the Gilda Lehrman Institute, gildalehrman.org, about probably 15 years ago, I don't know how many years ago it was, I had the privilege of co-creating a TV series called Liberty's Kids for PBS. And Liberty's Kids was a 40 animated half hours with Walter Cronkite playing Benjamin Franklin, and we had Arnold Schwarzenegger as Baron von Steuben, and we had basically everybody, because it was PBS and everybody wanted a piece of it. But it was the story of the founding of the country, the American Revolution, as seen through the eyes of three small kids attached to Benjamin Franklin's newspaper. And it still plays. It played on PBS. It was on Fox, and it still plays in DVDs. And it's amazing how when you present – now, we pitch that to little kids, to young people. But it resonated with parents and grandparents who watched it with their kids, who in many ways were hearing some of these stories. But you mentioned Phyllis Wheatley. I wrote a half hour about Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley, if you have never heard the name, was a slave in Boston. She was owned when Massachusetts still had slavery. But she was a poetess and a published poetess. And she wrote to George Washington, and George Washington wrote back to her, which was a remarkable thing for a Southern Virginian slave owner to do. And actually talked about Phyllis Wheatley as a bright hope for the future. There are amazing stories that took place, and I have always felt that Superman is the dumbest myth. I could be Superman, James, if the only thing that can kill me is kryptonite and it's not found on this planet. But to be a Washington or a Hamilton or a Jefferson, to put your name on a piece of paper that's treason and know that you will be hung from the highest yardarms if you fail, and do it anyway because you think it's the right thing, is an act of political courage that we could only dream about today.
You're so right. We need some political courage. I love your point about Washington and Phyllis Wheatley. I actually specialize in that period myself. And many people think that Washington's attitudes towards black people and slavery began to change precisely because of his encounter with Phyllis Wheatley. He'd never seen anybody like her before in his life. And it changed everything for him. Well, eventually, in his will, he freed his own slaves.
And, by the way, set up a pension that paid off into the 1840s, because he knew to free slaves without any means of support would be not doing anybody a favor. He's my personal hero. I think he's another one of these figures. And Chernow wrote about Washington, too. It's a great book.
A great book, yeah.
And, in fact, one of the great moments in Hamilton is Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is our George Gershwin, who is our Shakespeare. He took Washington's farewell address and turned it into a song. It's the actual words of the farewell address, and you've got millions of kids singing it.
Yeah.
I mean, this
miracle
is a gift of history. In case you haven't noticed, I'm pretty excited that you're in town to do this, and I can't wait. And if I could be of any assistance, I'm in. So,
Doug, I want you to come to one of the matinees. I'll send you the dates. The dates were in L.A. with kids in the house.
I'd love to.
It'd be wonderful if you could come.
Be thrilled to do it. James, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for doing this. And we'll talk to you again, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Doug. We'll be in touch.
All right. We circle back to a story that we have covered over a number of years, and that is the nuclear, one of the really big and dangerous nuclear accidents in the history of America, well, about Three Mile Island. But right here in Southern California, in the Santa Susana Pass, we had an incident that continues to essentially cause problems. And Joel Grover from our news partners, NBC4, their great investigative reporter, he's been on this story for a long time. He has an update on it. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, Joel Grover. Joel, how are you?
I'm great, Doug. Doug and Leanne, thanks for having me back, because this is such an important issue, as you pointed out. A huge contaminated site sitting on a mountain just west of Los Angeles. And the issue that we are looking at tonight, we're going to be airing a report again on our 5 p.m. news, has to do with summer camp. Parents all across our area are getting ready to send their kids off to camp next month. We all hope it's going to be a safe experience for our kids. There is a very famous large summer camp that sits right under the Santa Susana Field Lab. And for years, there has been testing and documentation that radioactive and chemical contamination from the camp migrates, from the field lab migrates onto the camp and to other areas under the field lab. Well, in late 2015, the NBCI team did some reports showing that there was contamination found at this camp in the water, in the soil, in the milk of the cows. The camp got very panicky, and they reached out to a state agency and asked them to give them cover and say, our camp is safe. Now that state agency has issued a report saying this famous camp is safe, despite the fact that there's contamination there. And we have spoken with insiders in this state agency who say this report is bogus. It is a whitewash. It is trying to downplay real risks, health risks to children, hundreds and thousands who will be going to this camp. So that's what we look at tonight. You know, is this state agency really protecting kids at a camp where contamination has been found?
And this is going to air at 5 p.m. tonight?
5 p.m. tonight.
Now, it's my understanding. I mean, I believe in the great indoors, Joel. I don't like to go outside if I could possibly avoid it. But people have been hiking up there for decades, and it's a popular place to go up. And people poke around in the old abandoned buildings, et cetera. I've seen people post numerous photos on social media
right.
on that. How is that a safe activity?
Well, you cannot. Now, let me say this. You cannot hike at the Santa Susana Field Lab. It's a gated, secured facility. However, the current owner, Boeing, is trying, has been asked for years by state lawmakers to clean up the contamination there. It would cost Boeing hundreds of millions of dollars. So Boeing right now is in the process, we know this because we've been digging around, of trying to turn the Santa Susana Field Lab into open space, park space, saying basically that if people just go hiking there, then the contamination isn't a risk if they're only there a few hours every year as opposed to living there. People do hike in the area, but they do not hike right on the field lab. However, I want to point out again, you have a summer camp just below the field lab where you do have kids playing in the dirt, sometimes in the water. There's organic gardens there, even though the camp now says people don't eat from the gardens. What's the point of having an organic garden if you don't eat from it? But again, people are in the land, whether they're hiking or walking or playing in it, just below the field lab. And I want to point this out. Visualize this. This very contaminated former site where, as you pointed out, there was a nuclear meltdown. There were rocket tests. There were nuclear accidents on this mountain that's still contaminated. It sits right above a camp, right above a housing development, hiking areas. Studies have shown when it rains, that contamination migrates off.
Is there no way to make Boeing clean it up? I know it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, so they're going to stall, I'm sure. But, like, why aren't they cleaning it up? And why isn't anybody making them?
Well, you know what? We've had that question for Boeing since we started really investigating and reporting on this 2 years ago. Boeing will not sit down and talk to us. They say, if you have questions, email them to us. Well, they won't talk to us and answer that question. There are studies that show that place should be cleaned up. There are lawmakers that say it should be cleaned up. There are scientists within the state agencies that oversee the contamination that say it must be cleaned up. All I can tell you is a lot of people in state government have said Boeing doesn't want to spend the money that it would take to clean that up, maybe $500 million. We have that question for Boeing, and we have not had a chance to ask them that because they won't talk to us.
Is there Superfund cleanup funds available?
That's a great question, Doug. It gets into a complicated area. There could be ways to pay for it. Certainly the owner, again, Boeing, would probably have to pick up some of the cost. You know, I will tell you, a scientist once said to me, if Boeing, which owns a lot of contaminated land across the country, agreed to clean up the Santa Susana Field Lab, would that then open them up to being pressured to clean up other toxic facilities they own? This is such a complicated issue, but it's very interesting. The current governor of California has not leaned on Boeing to clean up the Santa Susana Field Lab, even though many politicians have pleaded with Governor Brown to get involved in this. By the way, for 2 years, we've wanted to talk to Governor Brown about the Santa Susana Field Lab. Why is his administration allowing one of the most contaminated sites in California to stay the way it is? There's been a little cleanup, but most of the contamination has not been cleaned up. The governor's office doesn't want to talk about it. It's very interesting. This is kind of a political hot potato in California now that a lot of politicians just don't want to talk about.
It's amazing they can clean up Fukushima, but they won't clean up something right here in our backyard in Los Angeles.
And that is the point. It is right in our backyard. This is a site that sits right above housing developments that are being built on the L.A. County, L.A. City side of the Santa Susana Field Lab. There are more homes being built on the Ventura County, Simi Valley side. This thing is sitting there right above L.A. and Ventura counties.
Well, see the full report this afternoon, this evening at 5 p.m.
5 o'clock news. And, you know, Doug, I know I'm going to be on your show again, maybe for years talking about this, because this is an issue that isn't going away.
No, it's not. And, you know, it's fascinating. It reminds me of in a microcosm of, like, the California public employee pension time bomb that's out there, which is obviously doesn't have a lethal aspect to it. But sometimes when the problem is too expensive, then they just go full ostrich on us. I mean, they'll caterwaul about a lot of things, but in some cases they just simply say, well, we can't afford it, so we're just going to pretend it's not there.
Right. And again, the push now is to turn this into park space.
How is that even? That's just incredible to me.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's incredible. But again, this is not a story, I think, that's going away anytime soon, no matter what happens there. If it's turned into a park, there's been talk in the past that there might be Native American tribes that want to build a casino up there. You know, you can do all that stuff. But I think there's a lot of people that are never going to forget it's a highly contaminated site. Do you want to go up there? It's your choice.
All right. Hey, listen, thanks so much. Appreciate you coming on with us.
5 p.m. today on NBC4. Thank you guys again for having me on to talk about this.
I always appreciate it, Joel. Joel Grover from our news partner, NBC4. By the way, every day from 4:30 to 5 right before we come on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can't beat them, join them. And that seems to be, in so many cases, what we do here in L.A. and in California. If you can't eliminate a problem
surrender.
Through law enforcement.
Surrender.
Just legalize it. Problem solved. And the latest version of this is illegal apartments, bootleg apartments. And I love this. We've now fully adopted the language of the immigration debate and applied it to where the illegal immigrants largely live. Because now we have a path to legalization for some bootleg apartments. So we have undocumented apartments. And they will now be legalized. Let's talk. We do obviously have a tremendous housing crisis in the city of Los Angeles. Let's talk with the president of the Delray Residents Association, Elizabeth Pollack. Elizabeth, how are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
So I have been telling the story for years. On my block, we had a house on the corner that had, we don't know how many people living in it. And I have an update on this, by the way. About 6 weeks ago, they bugged out in the middle of the night. House completely empty. All the cars were gone. 12, 13 cars on the block, gone. And a giant roll-off dumpster just went away yesterday after cleaning out tons of trash from the house. But I digress. There were people in the apartment, in the garages, etc., and pipes running through the attic in order to bring water to the other side of the building when there weren't bathrooms there, etc. And this is happening all over the city, where people have got tenants living in garages, etc., that were not zoned or permitted for that.
Correct. We sent our letter opposing this idea back in August of 2014, and we did it because the people that are there saying we're going to have these bootleg apartments be legal and correct. But if those units are supposed to be up to code, part of that code is the community plan that says how many people can live in a particular area. What is the density supposed to be? And the city has taken the position that if it's housing, we don't care what the plan says. We don't care if there's infrastructure to support the building. Obviously, you're not going to have, the city council did not approve having buildings with wires running every which way and bootleg plumbing that doesn't work. They're trying to say that you can legalize your bootleg apartment if you meet code. But our problem with it is that part of the code is the underlying community plan that tells you how many people, how many units can be built in a particular area. And particularly in our community, we have had real issues with buildings being more dense than they are supposed to be, buildings being out of character with the rest of the neighborhood. We are not New York City. We are a low-density residential community, yeah, and we like it that way.
Well, these are basically unpermitted apartment buildings that are popping up across the city. That's what we had on our block. And it changed the character of the block. Again, it was like living in a parking lot. There were cars all the way up the streets. A guy was running an auto shop out of the garage, his commercial business out of the garage. At one point, they had a convicted violent rapist, a guy who raped at knife point, who was being warehoused there at $500 a month. The state of California was actually paying them to house the guy. Cops called all the time. And again, there was nothing to code in there. There was nothing to code in the house whatsoever. Now, you know, contractors have bought it and they'll put some money into it and flip it. And who knows what will happen next. But this is going on all over the city. The city knows it. And the city doesn't, frankly, care. And they haven't cared. This is what Measure S was about.
That's correct.
And unfortunately, Measure S was defeated at the polls, and soundly so. So it's back to the developers will do what they want. And the city is taking a lot of heat because there is not affordable housing for our massive number of poor people. So they don't want to take any housing away, including housing that's substandard and illegal. And they don't care that people like you or me have complaints.
Boy, you just have to wonder, Doug and Elizabeth, if something like the tragedy that took place last year in Oakland, with, I don't know, 36 people dying because they were living in illegal houses in a warehouse and they had parties there and everything else, were burned in that terrible fire because the city just wasn't interested in bringing anything up to code.
Well, they're not. And the thing is, they say that they are, but what kind of enforcement will there actually be? And good luck, you know, once you legalize it, does that mean banks now have to write mortgages for illegal units because the city says it's legal? The first house I owned in California had an unpermitted room in the back. And when I bought the house, the bank wouldn't lend on 10% of the value of the home because they said that room is not up to code. So the guy I bought it from had to carry paper himself. We'll follow the story. Who's your city council person?
Mike Bonin.
And what does he say?
He says he's in favor of it.
He thinks
because his bottom line is he wants to provide housing, as much affordable housing as he can get, for all the people that need it.
Well,
and our issue is, fine, provide the housing, but the city controller did an audit in January that basically said that allowing affordable units to be built by private builders and not instead of having entire buildings that were affordable doesn't work.
Well, here's the thing. This is never going to change until Mike Bonin loses his job. And that's a sad reality. Until local elected officials are voted out of office by their constituents because they have ignored the legitimate complaints of the bill payers, this is going to continue. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
If you need work on your suntan or moontan, KLOS is here to help nearly every hour this weekend with free tickets to any one of these killer shows.
All of them
in the great outdoors.
Arroyo Seco with Tom Petty, Styx with REO Speedwagon, Boston with Joan Jett, John Mellencamp, Brian Wilson, Blackest of the Black with Danzig, Dead & Company, The Fab Four. We supply the concert tickets, you supply the SPF. Listen to win all weekend on the Rock of Southern California, 95.5 KLOS.
This is Bill's Yard, and Bill's a grill master, not a grass expert. Still, no weeds belong in this backyard barbecue kingdom. And with Scott's Turf Builder Weed and Feed, Bill's greasy thumb is just as good as a green thumb. Because Scott's thickens lawns to help crowd out over 50 pesky weeds. So Bill can defeat invaders, green up his lawn, and hold his spatula high. This is a Scott's Yard. Pick up Scott's Weed and Feed today.
AutoZone presents Wash and Wax. Washing your car removes road grime and dirt buildup that can scratch your car's finish, while a good coat of wax helps protect that beautiful shine. And right now, get a 32-ounce bottle of Black Magic Tire Wet for just $5.99. So visit your local AutoZone. With over 275 Greater Los Angeles locations, the right supplies and good advice are just around the corner. Let's get you what you need. See store for restrictions and details.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Yeah, your toilet's definitely clogged, but I think I found the problem. Sir, is this your action figure?
Yes, I sent him in to check out the pipes.
As a small business owner, you've got enough to deal with. Let the experts at Progressive insure your business so you can focus on more important things. With over 30 commercial, auto, and business coverage options, we'll build a plan that's right for you.
I got something else. Are these toy cars?
Had to send in backup.
Visit ProgressiveCommercial.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
To get great Western style, you need great boots. To find the perfect boots for every occasion, head to Boot Barn for the largest selection of Western and work boots in the styles you love. Get concert ready with fun fringe booties from Cheyenne, or hit the road in a pair of handcrafted Cody James exotic boots. Headed for the job site? Stop in for boots that work as hard as you do. Now, save $20 to $50 on select boots. Step out in style in your new favorite boots from Boot Barn.
You know what scares most people? Spiders, heights, public speaking. You know what scares me? Unused inventory. I find the prospect terrifying. Got goosebumps just thinking about it. That's why we use Grainger. Grainger's inventory management solutions make sure our facility has exactly what we need when we need it. No overstock, no understock, no goosebumps. When it comes to inventory management, Grainger's got your back. Call clickgrainger.com or stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
In 20 feet, stay single until you're 34. Recalculating. In 5 feet, don't have kids until you've done it all. Recalculating. In 10 miles, go petless until you buy a bigger place. Recalculating. The all-new, redesigned, re-engineered 2017 Jeep Compass. Whatever your destination, there's a million beautiful, ever-changing ways to get there. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Allergy sufferers are hearing a lot of numbers these days about symptoms and relief. But the number sufferers want most is zero, as in zero nasal allergy symptoms. And nothing gets you closer to zero than Nasacort. Because unlike antihistamines that stop only one cause of your allergy symptoms, Nasacort stops more. And stopping more gets you closer to zero. For 24-hour relief of your worst nasal allergy symptoms, including congestion, choose Nasacort. It stops more of what makes you miserable. Use as directed.
Allergies. Pollen in the air. Dogs in the house. Mold in the basement.
Whatever triggers your allergy symptoms, it can really hold you back. Break through with Allegra 5-in-1 Relief. Allegra works fast, won't make you drowsy, provides 24-hour multi-symptom relief, and it's effective every day. Break through allergies with Allegra. Starts working in 1 hour. Use only as directed. Guaranteed or your money back. Visit Allegra.com.
I remember that night talking with my friend Stacy. Well, she was really down, you know, hopeless, feeling like she had no future. I could hear and feel her pain because I remembered it happening to me. And as I listened, it turned out she was thinking about suicide. Teen suicide is a real problem, but recognizing the warning signs can help save a life. Thankfully, I got through it with Save.org. And as of now... So did she. She's much better. Help your friends at save.org.
At Orchard Supply Hardware, they believe no project is too small. Discover your own can-do spirit with helpful know-how and quality products for all your paint, repair, and backyard projects. Orchard Supply Hardware. Home, hardware, and happiness. Find a store near you at osh.com.
Who doesn't love pancakes? Nobody. Go to Burger King now and get 3 golden pancakes for 89 cents. May be hard to believe, but it's true. Also, try 2 croissant sandwiches for $4. Only at Burger King. Limited time at participating Burger King restaurants. Restrictions apply.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
We had an election this week, and Angelenos in minuscule numbers went to the polls despite $15 million in spending on the school board election alone. And despite the low turnout, the impact of this election could be significant, really significant. For the first time, we are told, for the first time in the LAUSD school board's history, the majority of the board are considered to be supporters of charter schools. And what does this mean going forward for public education in the city of Los Angeles? Well, let's turn to the guy who has been covering the schools exclusively and extensively for years. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show education reporter for the LA Times, Howard Bloom. Howard, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. First of all, are you surprised that Nick Melvoin won?
Well, you couldn't be too surprised because in many elections, the candidate with the most money is going to win. I would say that's true most of the time. And when you have local elections where people aren't paying that much attention, and frankly, the media isn't necessarily giving it a lot of attention, and we weren't writing about this election every day. We wrote about it, but not every day. Then the messages are often dominated by the campaign spending, and there was a lot of spending. And to be sure, the other side had a lot of money too, but the Nick Melvoin side seemed to have virtually unlimited resources, at least in the context of this campaign.
And where did the money come from?
The money came directly from charter school-friendly organizations like California Charter Schools Association Advocates. That's one of those 501c4s, right? And there were also organizations set up for this election. There was a group called something like Students Against Steve Zimmer, which actually had very little to do with Students Against Steve Zimmer. That was just the name of the committee. Another committee was called the Parent-Teacher Alliance, very similar to the PTA, but that was a sublet of the Charter Schools Association Fund. And the money to the Charter Association was coming from a relatively small group of very wealthy people, a fairly diverse group of people. They're not diverse in terms of the fact that they're all very rich, but politically diverse in some ways. It definitely included some Democrats as well as some very conservative Republicans and libertarians.
And Steve Zimmer had the backing of the teachers' union, sort of the traditional LAUSD establishment. And normally you would think, okay, Nick Melvoin's got a lot of money behind him, but Zimmer has got the ability to get the union vote out, and that's a lot of people, a lot of family members. But he was defeated rather soundly. It wasn't a close election when all is said and done. And what does that actually mean for us going forward? What does it mean to have a majority charter school membership of the LAUSD school board?
Well, partly we don't know. I mean, one thing that the union found out when the union had what it considered a majority friendly on the school board is that they did not get everything they wanted, because there are certain things that pertain to the job, as Donald Trump has learned. For example, you can say anything you want on the campaign trail, but when you're elected president, you still have to have a policy to deal with China. You can't beat up on China all the time, and the job pulls you in certain directions regardless of what your supporters think you're going to do when you get in office. And it remains to be seen. I mean, part of the job of this board is to keep the LA Unified School District in business. And if having an unlimited amount of charter schools drives the LA Unified School District out of business, and I'm not saying that would be a good thing or a bad thing, I'm just saying it could be a thing, well, then maybe this board would not do that. But to answer your question specifically, yes. They would like it to be easier to get charter schools approved. They would like it easier to get charter schools re-upped because they have to get renewed every 5 years. They would like the Inspector General's office to be what they consider more reasonable in targeting charter schools for investigation. LA Unified actually has an Inspector General. Not everybody knows that. And one of the things they do is investigate charter schools on occasion. They would also like more access to money to build charter schools because LA Unified controls school construction bonds. And they would like better and faster access to what they consider unused space on existing campuses. So that's a brief agenda.
The charter phenomenon has been around for quite a while now. And there's a lot of data on performance over decades now. Do charter schools perform better than traditional public schools?
If you look just at the test scores, especially in LA, they do perform a bit better than LA Unified schools. They do not perform as well as LA Unified magnet schools on the whole, but LA Unified is proving so many magnets, it remains to be seen if they can maintain that caliber of performance. Just as important is the question of why they are doing a little better on test scores, because if they are doing better on test scores because they don't take more difficult students or because of self-selection, that the students going to charters tend to be more motivated families because they have to find and choose them, then that doesn't really tell us much about how you make schools better. On the other hand, if they do better because of better management efficiency, better employee work rules, maybe they can get rid of bad teachers more easily, then that is something we can learn for. So it isn't just looking at the test scores, and test scores don't tell you everything you need to know about a school, but it's why, and the why we don't have clear answers on even to this day.
Yeah, and that kind of surprises me because the why of this, and I totally agree, tests are only one measure. And we have to have some kind of measure, so we've agreed on tests. But it's only one measure. Even, you know, college applications, we're actually starting to see colleges and universities drop the SATs as a requirement to get in because they look at that as you can get a false positive and a false negative from the SATs. There's a lot of other things that go into human development. But knowing the why of higher performance of a school is critical because those, you know, that's where we learn what reforms are necessary for the rest of the school system. If there are schools out there that are experimenting with different management styles and different teaching techniques and different fill in the blank, then we need to transpose that into the broader population of schools if we're ever going to advance the ball.
Right, but there also is no one formula, just as there's no one school that you could say, oh, every single student should go to this kind of school.
Right.
So to some degree, there is something to be said for choice and having options and different kinds of schools, as long as you can try to maintain quality in all those options.
We're talking with Howard Bloom, as the education reporter for the LA Times, so you can follow on Twitter at Howard Bloom. Steve Zimmer gave one of the least graceful concession speeches that we've seen in a long time. He was pretty bitter about losing his job. And I'm wondering if that bitterness is reflected in the split on the LAUSD school board going forward between Nick Melvoin wing, if you will, the pro-charter school wing and the non-charter school wing that remains.
I don't know the answer to that. Often in these elections, it's bitterest right after the election. And Bennett Kaiser, another union-backed candidate who lost, was very bitter about his defeat. And the reason for their bitterness is that those candidates felt their records were misrepresented and that the election was being fought on grounds other than the things that the funders really cared about. So you didn't hear a lot about we need more charter schools or we need more protection or better rules for oversight of charter schools, which arguably is what the money was fighting for. Instead, you heard about a lot about iPads again. And certainly Steve Zimmer bears a share of responsibility for that. But ironically, the iPads were the mastermind project of somebody these charter school supporters really like, a former superintendent who put that forward. So that, you know, you can see how Steve Zimmer is bitter, but it doesn't matter whether he can put it aside. He's not on the board anymore. It matters whether everybody else can put it aside. And maybe they can. You know, there's still a job to do up there.
Yeah, the exact quote that jumped out was, I may have lost an election, but my soul is intact. And he said of Nick Melvoin, they and his supporters, they know what they did. You know, which is really kind of a dark election night statement. But nonetheless, this really is less about personality now that the election is over, and it's more about where we go from here. Zimmer pointed to improvements, and certainly there have been improvements in the graduation rates. But one of the ways that LAUSD has shown improvement is by lowering the standards of what we consider to be acceptable grade levels for, I mean, for instance, and I think that this is sadly true in many cases, that a lot of graduates of LAUSD really don't qualify for admission into the UC system. So we've still got a long way to go.
Right, and that's always been true. And in fact, no large urban school system in California, and perhaps maybe not any school system, has qualified all its graduates for admission to the UC Cal State system. And LA Unified ambitiously had this plan to say all of our graduates are going to qualify, and they're getting close to about half at the moment, which is their best ever, but it's still half. Now, should qualifying to go to a UC system school, should that be what you need to graduate from high school? Because you could graduate and still qualify for other schools or qualify for community colleges. So there's a lot of debate over that issue. Certainly, we don't want a high school diploma to be meaningless, but we also want to allow for a variety of life paths without penalizing students. But the fundamental part of that is that there's the belief that if you push and demand high standards of students, and not just students, but the entire system, that you will get a better result. And there is research to back up that fundamental point. How you get there is still a matter of some debate.
Howard, last question, and I need to pick your brain on this just because my brain isn't functioning on this topic anymore. I lost track of what happened to the schools that Antonio Villaraigosa, when he was mayor, took over. The mayor wanted more control over the schools. He wrestled control of a small number of schools into the mayor's office. What is the status of that program?
Those schools have, by and large, improved significantly. By and large, they still have very low test scores. So they are somewhat mirror the school district in the sense that when you're down so low, you have I feel like I'm writing a song lyric. When you're down so low, there ain't nowhere to go but up.
Exactly.
But you know what?
Trisha Yearwood recorded that last year.
but you could not go up, right? Or you could even go down. So the people running those schools say our schools have improved more than other schools on average. And I think that's true. But that's true of all very low-performing schools in LA Unified. They've all improved more than the average partly because they've had further to go. So it's not like it's a total failure. And you know, one thing in defense of what the mayor was trying to do, he wasn't doing a charter where there's, I don't want to say selective enrollment, but self-selection to some degree. And he took some of the worst, and I'd put this in parentheses, in quotation marks, worst of the worst schools and has tried to make them better. And to some degree, they are better. So it's not a blazing success. I wouldn't say it's a complete failure either. There is some progress there, but a long way to go.
Well, I'm curious about the mechanics, the physical mechanics of administration, where you've got LAUSD schools, you've got charter schools, you've got this small group of schools that are run from the mayor's office.
They're not run from the mayor's office anymore. A different mayor, right? Right. So Garcetti has not taken on that project, and Villaraigosa is not really doing it either. What's happened is there's now a nonprofit board And Melanie Lundquist was one of the main funders of this from the beginning, so she is a driver of this. So Villaraigosa is a little bit attached to this project, but it's kind of going on its own without a mayor at this
point. That's what I was curious about, what happened to it in the post-Villaraigosa years. Thanks so much, Howard. Really appreciate you coming on with us.
Happy to do it.
Every one of you is walking around with some form of smartphone on you. And if you don't have that, you've got Alexa or you've got a Roomba, you've got a smart television, you've got a digital device. We are surrounded by these things. And we love them to death. When people lose their cell phones, they literally feel like they've lost a kidney, that a piece of them is missing.
It's a phantom pain. It's like you've lost an appendage.
And but the downside of this is that all that convenience and all that entertainment, all those cat videos, all that swiping right, means that your personal information can be swiped as well. And in some cases, just mined 24/7 by the device that you think is your friend. To talk to us about this is NBC4's consumer investigative reporter, Randy Mack. Randy, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, how you guys doing this morning?
A-OK. So
you sound like my 13-year-old son when his phone is missing or if he can't find it, man. You
total panic.
Throwing a fit. Yeah.
Total.
Throwing a fit.
An absolute panic. And that's not uncommon. You see people literally get the shakes, like they have digital addiction programs now. But you've looked into this story and concluded that our digital footprint is being tracked an amazing 400 times a day on the average user's phone. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. And part of the issue, at least with phones, are apps. I mean, do you guys use a lot of apps? Do you have a lot of apps on your phone?
I don't. I actually don't because I'm a half a Luddite, but I do have some apps. I use Waze for traffic. I use Lyft Uber. So I do have apps that I use, although not as many as I think most smartphone users would use.
Well, even in the case of Waze, you know, Waze is tracking you because it's telling you. Hey, there's an accident ahead, or where are you at? Are you about to hit it? I mean, it's literally tracking your location data. And that's part of the problem. I mean, when you're downloading apps, what you're doing is you're giving permissions. You're allowing people to track you and locate you. Now, it might not matter very much to you, but if it's your child, you might not want people to be able to track your child's location or know that your child is at the mall hanging out with buddies, you know, and things of that nature. So a lot of the problem is centers around apps that we allow, we download, we keep them on our phones. And we keep them forever because a lot of people think that they're just so convenient. And with the touch of a button, they can find out what they want instantaneously. They keep it. But what they don't realize is that you're giving up some of your privacy in return. Not only are they tracking you, they're tracking you primarily to target you for advertising. So that is the purpose. They're not just tracking you. They're selling that information where you're at, when you're in the mall, when you're at a museum.
Hey, Randy.
Yes.
I mean, I look at that as a positive thing. We started having this discussion a few years back with the grocery store cards.
Right.
And they would track what you buy at the grocery store, and then they would give you coupons according to what you purchased. I like applesauce, and the next time I went to the store, I had, you know, 25% off Mott's applesauce. And
right.
I thought, you know what, that's pretty convenient because that's something I need. If I don't want to buy something, I won't buy it, no matter what my smartphone tells the advertiser that I might be interested in. So I don't have a problem with that, and I think a lot of this privacy nonsense is, if you don't talk about identity theft, you're talking about people just knowing where you are. I mean, how self-important are we? There's 320-some million of us in the country. I mean, nobody cares where you are, you know what I'm saying? I mean, can you have that point of view?
Well, you can have that point of view, but the thing is, the data is being collected and sold.
But mostly so they can advertise
to you. Yes, but not exclusively. And the thing is where it comes, where it becomes an issue is, I don't know, a divorce case. And all of a sudden somebody subpoenas the records of where you were.
All right.
Example, Randy, yesterday Rob mentioned on the air, I happened to have a smartphone with him in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Burger King on the air. And what happened?
Well, I got an ad for a Whopper
within
Burger King.
Within 20 seconds of saying the word Burger King, his phone sent him a coupon for a Whopper.
Yeah.
Doesn't that creep you out a little bit?
No. It made me hungry, and I was able to, you know.
And, Randy, I think what Rob represents, because I do find the stuff creepy, But I do think that Rob represents the overwhelming majority of Americans who understand that these things are spying on them and sign up for the frequent eater program at Ralph's anyway.
Well, on top of that, they're
posting
where they
are. Let me ask you this, then, Rob. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Do you like it when you receive robocalls?
No.
Because people have tracked you and sent your information to advertisers or to people, and they're calling you.
And I'll tell you.
You don't like that.
I'll tell you why, Randy. Because that's my time. You know, that takes my time. If somebody is tracking me while I'm doing stuff, it's not taking any of my time. When the phone rings and I have to pick up the phone and answer, that's taking my time. I'll obviously hang up on the robocalls. So that is inconvenient. I'm not worried about it, just inconvenient.
I hear you. I think people's reaction to it is tantamount to getting a robocall. I mean, why is this person calling me? Why do they know information about me? Why am I being targeted? You know, I think there are a lot of people out there who are concerned that strangers know more about them than they should, you know, and that I think is unnerving to some people. Now, maybe not to everyone, but to some people, I think it's unnerving that there are people out there who are literally targeting you and they're tracking you through your own devices.
We're talking with Randy Mack, NBC4 consumer investigative reporter, who you can follow on Twitter at RandyNBCLA. The sea change here is that we've had telephones for a very long time.
Right.
And they were one-way devices. They only communicated when we picked up the receiver and we dialed or we answered somebody who called us. And the idea that it's passively listening in all the time on what we do is a very big change. Certainly, if you had a neighbor who had a stethoscope up to the wall of your apartment and was listening into your private conversations, you get a restraining order against that person. But for the convenience that the digital world offers us, we voluntarily click accept on the terms and conditions to allow these things to do it. And it's got big political consequences. We just had the FCC and the administration and Congress change the net neutrality laws. And the reason is that the Internet service providers are saying that, look, we're at a competitive disadvantage because Google, for instance, does this all the time. For using Gmail and for using the Google search engines, we give Google permission to basically go through our emails and look at our search history and pick up keywords and then target advertising based on the things that we've looked at.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that, you know, I don't mind advertisers, I guess, you know, randomly targeting me. I don't necessarily like that they know stuff about me. You know, if you want to do the old door-to-door salesman thing and just knock on doors and say, hey, do you want to buy a vacuum cleaner? That to me is fine. But to know that I might need a vacuum cleaner when you're knocking on the door ahead of time, to me, is kind of problematic.
All right, Randy, our news partner is NBC4. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Thank you guys for having me.
Appreciate it. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.